Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production.
Now available on Apple Podcasts,
Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
The Steve Austin Show is brought to you free today by our friends at BetOnline. Get in the mix at betonline.ag and use the promo code PODCAST1 for your 50% welcome bonus. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts and exclusive partner of Podcast One Sportsnet.
Podcast One presents the Steve Austin Show Classics.
All right, so anyway, I'm sitting here at the Broken Skull Ranch in South Texas, and I'm talking to one of my all-time favorites, as I've already said in my opening segment. I'm talking to the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes. Last time I talked to Dusty Rhodes, yeah. I was in Pleasanton, Texas at the Super Walmart, and my phone rings, and I looked down, and it was Dusty. And Dusty never calls me, but something had happened, and we end up shooting this shit in the parking lot for about 45 minutes. We booked three territories and had a good time. So yeah. I said, hey, dude, we got to do the show. So Dusty's on the other end of the line. Dusty, it's good to have you on the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Walmart, I don't know. I called you. I love you. I always have. I mean, I got finger friends. I got about 10 finger friends, and that's about it, man. And whether I see you or talk to you, you know, it doesn't matter. I know if I called and needed something, you'd be there. So it's just one of them days where I said, I'm going to give him a call. And we did because there was so much going on. And, hunting season, I was thinking about you. And, yeah, so.
Well, you know, when I first started doing this show, you know, I called you. You were one of the first guys I called. I said, hey, man, how about, you know, would you come on the show? We can talk promos, talk of business, talk.
Damn,
about,
man.
All these months.
Yeah, but it was.
But I know, but see, that was just, like you said, I had to pay some dues first, get my chops going a little bit, then call you back. So now we can have a more in-depth, well-rounded conversation.
As we always do.
Let's talk about deer season for a second, because as we talked, I think you were planning a hunting trip. I'm down here in South Texas. It's been real green down here. The weather has been hot. Everything is so green. They're not really coming any kind of corn, so I'm not really seeing any action. Have you been able to get out in the woods and do any hunting yet?
Yeah, we just about every weekend down in Worth County in Sylvester, South Georgia, on the farm down there. You know, I got a couple of friends, three or four friends there that, you know, that's all that's hunted on this one section, 640 acres there are so, and it's just been overrun with bucks. And the biggest buck in Georgia was killed last year in Worth County. And, so there's a lot of bucks and, you know, a lot of does and letting a lot of them walk. Eight pointer, I wish I would have got, I let walk. And it's the old hunting stuff, man. You know, you just, say, I'm going to come back and let him grow a year, you know, 3 years old, wait till he's four or something like that.
I agree.
And then, and then the next weekend, if, you know, one of my hunt buds takes his son-in-law there and, you know, they could send me a picture and I said, man, that looks like that deer I was talking about.
The one you were going to let walk.
Yeah, always when somebody brings a friend, they always kill your deer, man. You know what I mean? They say, so I said, I wish I'd have got him, but it's been good for me. Steve, that's my, beside my grandkids and my kids, man, and my family right now, and just getting out, man, it's just unbelievable for me to get out after 45 years. You know, last week we talked about me and you. November 14th was 45 years in this business. How many dressing rooms I've been in? How many showers? How many times I've seen Murdoch wake up in the bed next to me in the 6 days in? I mean, my God, it's just amazing. You know, when I go back and I take back and look at where I never really had another job, never really had a job. It just entertained my whole life. So,
with the hunting that you do, is that something that you grew up your whole life doing, or was that something you got on in later years? Because I know you were beaten on the road just like I was. There's several years I got out of hunting, and because I was on the road, Paul Orndorff, when I went down to WCW, you hired me for the job. And so then Paul ended up getting me back in the woods. But is deer hunting and the outdoors a lifelong passion for you?
Yeah, I've always enjoyed it because my dad, God rest his soul, you know, when out of Boston, we would go to San Antonio, Randolph Air Force Base, and, you know, and then even south going towards Uvalde. My grandma and grandpa, they had some property out there, and I remember going at an early age, and I didn't like it. I didn't like getting up in the morning, and I didn't like sitting there. I think it was probably about 7, 8 years old. I was in Little League Baseball and all this stuff and football in South Texas, so I'd go down there with him, and he would give me a 30-30, no scope, and he would try to not make me, but just wanted me to be with him, you know what I mean? And I would do it and sit there, and then it was, man, a lot of time went by, and then it wasn't until probably in the 1990s when the Eric Bischoff debacle and all that came about it at WCW, and I ended up kind of just, you know, being irrelevant as far as having to work every day, and so I just started back, man, and then Dustin, my oldest son, Goldust, he hunts with me, and Cody's the Prince of Pro Wrestling, as we call him. He has nothing to do with it. He would go if I asked him, but when I got back into it, Steve, when I jumped back into the hunt scene, it was like I had missed it, but I really didn't know it, and I had to learn everything. There's an art to it. I mean, you just can't go out and, I've always been a rifle carrier and always went out and shot, but when I got back into it and really, you know, for me, if I'm in a blind and I talk to you on the phone, it's because just being out there and just that peace of mind. Because after 45 years, I've found out that peace of mind is the most important thing. It overshadows money, overshadows everything else. Because if you took all the knives that are in my back that I've been stabbed through the years and all the bullshit stories that I had to lay on people to get them to do something that I wanted to do, and you put it all together, it's just, I just wanted some peace of mind here before I got too late into my 60s.
You hit the nail right on the head. I mean, sure, you know, when you go out, it'd be great to come back with a big-ass buck. That's wonderful. But most of the time, you do not, just because that's just simply hunting. And the point I'm getting at is it's just being in the woods, enjoying myself, the peace, tranquility, being in the middle of nowhere, seeing Mother Nature and watching things go down. It ain't necessarily always, it's never about the kill. That goes with it if you're lucky enough to happen upon something that you want to take. But I just enjoy the peaceful, the quietness, and being able just to take a deep breath of fresh air and just chill and relax and take all that, you know, whatever's going on in life. And before I started, before I brought you on, Dusty, I've always, every time we've talked on the phone, I've always wanted to talk to you about promos, because every now and then someone will, make up a promo list. Oh, who the best talkers were. Well, you're always on everybody's list, and if you're not on someone's list, then they don't know their ass from a hole in the ground about promos. I played the Hard Times promo in my opening segment, and you've cut so many memorable promos throughout your career. Let's spend a little bit of time specifically talking about that. What was your approach to creating your promo style? I mean, your cadence, your rhythm, the way you talk. I mean, you're born with a little bit of a lisp, right, Dust?
And a lot of lisp. Yeah, but, handicapped or whatever.
But I know, but that worked. That worked for you, because I mean, the way you put your words together, I mean, it drew me in. You're a little bit older than me. You're the generation ahead of me, so I grew up watching you and just listening to you talk and the emotions. It was like, man, of course, I just loved what you stood for. You were the working man. And all these years later, I do this podcast for the working man, but I was drawn to what you were saying, because I knew that you were feeling what you were saying. But so many times, and I watch, your stuff, in the Carolinas with the Crockett's, and then, when you went to Vince, a lot of those ringside promos and the stuff you were spitting out was just pure audio gold. And it just say, hey, man, if I had the money and I was right there, I'm buying a ticket to see this cat wrestle. Were you always a gifted talker?
I think I was gifted and being able to have a vision of what I wanted to say spontaneously. Not in let's go. It's like when you have done the, your movie work and all the stuff that you've done. You're in a script. And I teach my kids now at developmental at WCW. I teach them in the acting class that I teach is that's fine and dandy. But no matter what you're handed, it still has to come out of your mouth, has to be you. Growing up in the Sunday in the Black Baptist Church that we went to over in Bastrop, Texas, with my dad when he would go over there every Sunday and visit T.C. Lou, who worked plumbing with him. And I would sneak over to that church just like you read about in the movies, and I would hear them sing. And I'd hear the gospel, and I'd hear him talk. And I grew up in that neighborhood where, dominantly Black neighborhood and Latino neighborhood. So I finally realized this. It was not like a repetition that came all over my head or whatever they call it, that I got this thing from outer space somewhere, is that the wrestling part was cool. the story in the ring is cool because you got a blank canvas. You got an opportunity with a blank canvas when you walk out there and you'll paint in 20 minutes or an hour, whatever you, however long you go, you're painting your own portrait. They'll either buy it or they won't. But I understood at an early age that the old, I'm going to see you Friday night and kick your ass in Orlando, Kevin Sullivan, and I'm going to beat you up, and that's at 8 o'clock, and don't forget to buy your tickets at Walmart. Well, that's fine and dandy, man, but, you know, the common man don't want to hear that, man. They wanted to hear what I had to say about current events blended in with the way I told it and the way I told the story. And, yeah, they knew I was going to be in Orlando. I didn't have to tell them I was going to be in Orlando. I didn't have to tell them that I was going to be wrestling Kevin Sullivan or whoever it was, or the Korean assassin. So I took that opportunity then to spontaneous relate to them how I was feeling on that moment, that morning, that day. And with the Hard Times promo, it was very simple. I was sitting in the control room. J.J. Dillon was my assistant at the time. He was sitting down below me. And I was sitting in the control room doing the show, booking the show, also starring in the program, also starring in TBS 605 for so many years. And he said, okay, you're up, just like that. J.J. turned around and said, yup, Dream. I took the headsets off. I walked out to the set. As I walked through the curtain, I knew that was a point in time where our country was in hard times. But not one thought did I give to this interview until it came out of my mouth. Not one thought till that interview came out of my mouth and became as famous as Gone with the Fucking Wind.
But you just, I never really, I've seen, you know, countless of your promos. When I was watching back in the day, on the Super Station, back in the heyday, or just pulling something up on YouTube, I just never seen a flub, a tick, a hitch. You just always seem to flow.
Yeah.
Of those were just ad lib, spontaneous, or did you ever?
No, they weren't, Stephen, as you know yourself, because you created a character that there's not anything like it in our modern, in your era. So we say in the 70s were the Rhodes era, and then they went to the Hulkamania era, and then they went to the Austin era, and now they go to the Cena era. I left out a lot of people in between there. I left out Rock, left a lot of people. But that was the era that dominates our landscape of our business. There's no other era. They were the king of them eras. I mean, as you went through the different eras, that's how it flowed. I mean, we're going to talk about Superstar and talk about Ric Flair, but really that was the power of them different eras that I just named. So with that being said, you also had that opportunity to pretty much go out there once they turn you loose and you got in your mind, this is what I'm going to do, whether they like it or not. And it becomes real. So the audience believes that it's real. They believe what they were saying. And I wanted them to think one thing. If you were an attorney, you could sit down and eat with me in a fancy restaurant. If you were a black person, you could sit and invite me over and I would eat in your living room. If you were white, I would do this in your living room. I would play with your kids. I was a cowboy. So I tried to encompass one thing, and Steve, always remember this, and I try to teach this too, is if I'm selling, I want them all selling in the audience. If I'm coming back, I want them all coming back. If I'm bleeding, I want them bleeding. If I win, they win. If I lose, they lose. Once you encompass that whole concept of our industry, that's when you become a power broker. And power broker, I did, like it or not, with all the knocks or whatever and all the great things that happened, I'm very blessed. Power broker I was. You're a power broker. She's a power broker. You know what I mean? And Hogan was a power broker at the time. There were four. There were power brokers. That's not saying I'm better than Ric Flair or anything. Or better than Steve Austin. I'm just saying, doing in 70s, 80s,
right,
90s,
right.
2000.
Well, let's talk about what you just brought up a while ago. You said while you're teaching the kids that you're teaching down there at the WWE Performance Center in Orlando, Florida, Dusty.
Yeah.
So what exactly are you teaching these cats? Purely promos or also in-ring work?
No, there's the coaches. It's like minor league baseball, developmental system, the finest athletes in the world that we can find. We bring them in like to go to the university. They come in, they go to school. They're there 7 days a week. They have house shows that they go to. And then I have two classes. I have one tonight, but I'm teaching all during the week. We have rooms set up in this facility where they can go in and cut their own promos, show them back to me, their creative aspects. They can do all these things. But with that said, my main thing is that I call it communication class.
Good.
I don't call it acting class or a good friend of mine, Howard Fine, in L.A., has a great studio.
Yeah.
And I designed it a little bit after him. So I will take these 80 kids that we have now, girls and guys, and break them up into two classes. They have the opportunity to come in there, and I let them be themselves for that 3 hours a night. I let them go up and cut a one-minute promo, a 1:30 promo. But really, all I'm on to see is communication. How do they communicate when the red light is on and there are 50 million people watching instead of just 40 people at an independent show or a little house show somewhere? Will the people believe them? So it's my philosophy on how to draw people to the arena, how to become entertainers, and how to talk to the media, and how to talk to the sixth grade school kid, how to talk to the high school kid, how to talk to the college kid, how to talk when you walk up and meet Steve Austin. I mean, what you going to say? You're going to bumble over yourself and say, my God, you're going to Stone Cold Steve Austin. How are you going to react? There's communication. Eyeball, eyeball. Communicate with the audience. You got it made. They believe that you're real. They believe what you're saying is real, no matter how entertaining it is.
Right.
No matter how many bands come out and how much happens. If they believe you, that's what cuts the good ones from the bad ones. And that's the ones that make art successful. And I'm sure you found that in the movie. But that I teach all the aspects of communication and entertainment. I'm the WWE's developmental head of creative. So creative means come to me with a pitch. You want to drive a truck in the building, a beer truck in the building? Well, we already done that, okay? But
right.
When I say that somebody's already done that, when I say Steve's done that, then I say, okay, now I got the concept. You had the vision. You got it somewhere from someone. Now make it your own. How would you do that different? How would you make that to where they say, oh, I've seen Steve do that? Or would they say, man, that's the first time I ever seen that?
Right.
So come up with something with your vision. And so all them things we teach you. And we move them up. And, you know, the White families just, you know, they came out of the developmental system. As a matter of fact, we have about 24 to 30 people in the last 4 years come out of this WWE developmental system that are now on the current roster. So it's an amazing, amazing bunch. And all the trainers and coaches there do a great job.
You're listening to another classic episode of The Steve Austin Show, only on Podcast One.
If sports keep coming back, so does your chance to bet on them with our exclusive wagering partner, BetOnline. With NASCAR, Formula One, and EPL in full swing, there's no shortage of ways to get in on the action. You need more? BetOnline has simulated NFL Madden games, NBA 2K, and UFC happening every day live for you to watch and wager on. And as sports get closer to returning, BetOnline has futures odds on everything you can imagine. Season win totals, division odds, and even odds on every league championship. Visit BetOnline.ag or use your mobile device to join now and use promo code PODCAST1 to receive your new welcome bonus. BetOnline, your online wagering experts.
So going back to, you know, when you started, Dusty, who broke you in the business and what made you say, because I go back to Houston Wrestling, and I think it was you in the ring. I could almost swear it was you in the ring, and you were bleeding badly, and I fell in love with wrestling. But what hooked you as a kid and would put you on a path to the destiny that you would take as the American Dream?
Let me tell you how this happened, and this is some honky stuff, man, because we were just talking about it on the 45th of my anniversary, and Michelle, my wife, you know, of 35 years, we were talking about this, you know, this moment. So I'm playing with the Hartford Charter Oaks in the Continental Football League, okay, and it's 1968, and I got cut from the Patriots. So I'm in the Continental Football League playing with Hartford with the Charter Oaks. The team folds, and I look in the newspaper, it says Boston Arena Annex. Friday night wrestling, Tony Santos wrestling. So I go down there, okay? Now then, I had been around all the Funks and Bobby Duncan, my bud from Austin, had started in the business, and they had all been there, and West, you know, at Amarillo,
yep.
Every Thursday night, going to wrestling, watching them. I loved it. It was the most unbelievable form of entertainment and express yourself that I could find. And so I was half-ass smart. And we say, well, he's smart back then.
Yep.
If you wasn't smart, man, somebody going to beat your ass. You know what I mean? and so they would say, so I said, okay, man. So I get there and I go in there and I'm standing. I buy a ticket. I got about $7 or $8 in my pocket. So I drive up to Boston Arena Annex, not Boston Garden. Yeah. So I go in there, and there's a promoter there, and he looks at me and said, "Well, man, you big guy, you ever tell about wrestling?" I said, "Yeah, I have, man. You know, I've been down with the funk." That's all I said. I didn't lie about it. I said,
"Yeah,
I've been down with the funk."
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, so that's it. He said, "Man," he said, "you know, you wanted to give this a try." I said, "Yeah, this is a true story, Steve." So he said, come in here on Monday. If you're around, come Monday." So I stayed there. And I lived in the car and outside of Boston because I didn't have enough money to stay anywhere. But I boxed golden gloves, so I had some little boxing shoes and a bathing suit. So I go down to the Boston Arena Annex, and there's a guy named Bill Graham, not the Billy Graham we know, a little short guy about 6 foot. He was a shooter, about 5'9" or something like that. He was what we call the shooter. So he said, "I want you to go out there," and they had the little sliding door in this old arena like you've seen in the movie. And he slid the little thing back to where he could just peer, like I couldn't see this guy, right? And he appeared watching. I went to the ring, and so I was really strong back then, about, you know, 210, 220, just come out of football.
Yeah.
I was in great shape, man, and this guy walks out there, you know, with the beer gut, and I ain't got nothing against beer gut, believe me. So he walks out there, and he said, "What do you know, kid? You know any hooks, you know, and everything?" I said, "Yeah, man, I know a lot of hooks." You know, like, that's up. I didn't know shit from shit all about this. Those are my hooks. Hook my ass, hook this, my hooks. So I said, so he grabbed a hold of me, and he tried to take me down, but he wasn't that strong, you know what I mean? So he couldn't take me down, and I didn't know nothing about amateur wrestling, absolutely dog nothing. And he couldn't take me down, and he struggled like for about 10 minutes, says, "Okay, you'll do." And that's the way I broke into business.
Yeah.
And then the next week, I wrestled Lenny Montana in the Boston Arena Annex in the main event, and then a guy named Frank Scarpa, who was the world champion, and then that little group. And I wrestled for the world title, my first match in the business.
You got to be kidding me. Jesus.
No,
Christ.
In the first match. And I had never been in the ring at all.
Well, then how the hell did you get a world title shot?
Because they wrote in the paper, they didn't even call me Dusty, they called me Sandy. Yeah. Sandy Reynolds from the Boston Patriots. Hell, I'd been cut by the Patriots.
Yeah.
You know, Nick Bonacani was there back then. That's how far back that was. They were, you know, and so they were the Boston Patriots. And I was at Hartford, and a big football star challenges Frank Scarpa for the world title in the Boston Arena Annex. Jesus. I mean, you know, and Bull Curry comes into me, and Bull Curry's there, and it's during the holidays, obviously, you know, Thanksgiving was coming up. And he says, he comes in and works with this guy, you know, every Thanksgiving, and he said, "Kid, there's two things you need, man, like a carpenter, man. You need an outfit, and you need to have a bunch of pictures." And I said, "Okay, sir, that sounds good." I was always respectful. And I met Rufus R. Jones there. He was Crazy Duke Graham was his name. Rufus R. Jones, man. We pulled our money together and had Thanksgiving dinner on the soup line in a kitchen in Boston, Massachusetts. So that's the whole story, and that is the true story, Stephen.
So you get in, you get a world title shot, you're greener than goose shit. So
no, not even greener than that, Steve. Greener than that.
Well, okay,
ain't got a word to do with it. Yeah, I was worse than that.
But okay, so that being said, what was the learning curve for you? Were you like a duck to water? Did you, I mean, cause wrestling really,
you
go to wrestling school, and there's been some great camps, just like the camp you guys got down there in Orlando with the WWE Performance Center. That's a world class camp, but you know, most of it really is back in the day. You know, I learned a little bit of stuff from Chris Adams, and I got out on the road, and it was on the job training. And so, clearly, that's pretty much what your whole career was, or your first learning curve was on the job training, because you didn't know shit from Shinola. How fast did you adapt and catch on?
Well, I had watched it all my life. My dad—that was my dad's big deal: get his check on Friday night and often go to the Coliseum. Watch wrestling. I'd emulated it in my backyard like every kid did. I don't know. It was something. It was a God-given gift that somebody just said, "You can do this without any training whatsoever." And it was just like, I remember the bell rung. I can remember this like it was yesterday, man. And a lot of things I can't remember. The bell rung, and I walked over, and he put his arms out, and I locked up him. And I locked up with him appropriately, and I wasn't too stiff. And as I locked up with this bastard, You know, he roughed me up a little bit, rolled me in, and the old timers always did this.
Yep.
Always did this. He slapped the dog shit out of me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, they backed you in, and he slapped me, and my reaction was, my first thought reaction was to slap him back, but then within a second, I thought, I got to sell this. And I didn't even know the word sell, what it meant.
Right.
I got to let the people know this hurt me. And I don't know. So then, 7 days a week, twice on Sunday, for 35 years, you know, my 45 in the business, for 30 years at least, on the road, that many days, twice on Sunday, 7 days a week, in a car, talking wrestling, and every day I got better and better and better. But the first time I walked out, and a few months later, when Fritz brought me into Dallas to the Sportatorium, and Danny Pletcher's named me Dusty Rhodes, and I walked out, I knew I had it. I
but
just
the wherewithal,
from that moment.
But the wherewithal right there, with the first slap, your initial reaction, slap the dog shit out of him back. But you had the wherewithal to sell. And selling to me was, you had so many strong points, but your salesmanship was off the charts. And you said it. You got to let those people know that that hurt you or nothing means anything.
Right.
And I remember, you know, when the Four Horsemen, you know, broke your ankle and, who was that, that put your damn eye, damn near put your eye out? Was that?
Yeah, Animal.
Road Warriors,
yeah, Road Warriors, Animal, when they got me with a spike and, you know, that threw TBS into chaos.
But so
it
many
threw,
guys,
Turner
they missed the point of selling, man. I mean, because if nobody can hurt you, nobody will give a shit. You were like you like to, you know, fancy yourself, you were offensive minded. But you were vulnerable, and when someone had you down, and you were in a world of pain, and those people were so behind you and wanted you, they were just waiting for that comeback. I mean, cheering for that comeback, and when it came, you gave it to them, and that's when the faces really got to let it all out. One thing you also did, which I really loved about your work, was the showmanship you put into it, whether it was kind of shaking your ass a little bit or kind of the little hand roll before you started dropping by on a
cable.
What brought that creative flair into your work? Was that just purely you saying, hey, this would be cool, or this is just how it happened for you?
By no means I compare myself to Elvis Presley, but he said one time about him shaking when he was singing.
Yeah.
I read an article way back, and he said it just comes. It just felt good. It just felt like something that would happen. And with me, it felt spontaneous for me. It just felt good for me. And it just it set me apart from the cookie cutters guys that we've all seen in this industry. And not blowing a horn is a big thing, because I with me, but I will tell you that this was my thought, and you don't agree with it probably, or you do, or it doesn't matter, because it did to me. As I sat in my living room and watched you with Bret Hart, and I remember that when you were bleeding and he had you in the hole, and you never gave up, and that was the finish. You finally just won out, and the longer you were in it, the longer the facial there. On that night, I said that Steve Austin just became a unbelievable mega superstar, and it was because of the sale. And then I take the young'un Cody, as his career has just taken off a little bit, and he's going around here with his brother. But I remember every pay-per-view during that era of him being very small in school and junior high and all that stuff, and he would watch it, and when you would finally turn it on to the selling part, not to the breaking of the glass,
not
to the driving in of the truck, when you were selling, he would turn to me and he said, now this is wrestling. He would always say that because he was such a student of it. So you go back and you name the ones that I talked about in the decades.
Yeah.
Hogan was not a great, Hogan by no means could work.
Right.
Okay, very well. But what he did well, for a big guy, he sold.
Yep.
He sold. And the people believed he was hurt. He brought them with him.
Yep.
And you go back, you go with John currently.
Yep.
And John sells.
Yep.
He sells the product. And the product is, this arm is hurt, I'm selling this son of a bitch. Okay? So, man, it's just, to me, it's easy. But it doesn't come easy for everybody. I see these kids struggle, these 80 kids, and we got more coming, and we do all the athletes and all the Olympic guys and all the football players coming for tryouts. and they can't even, they don't have a clue. They don't understand it.
Did you ever figure back in the day, though, that, I mean, because back in the day when I was, you know, coming in, I just thought everybody wanted to be a pro wrestler, probably like you and the guys that you were running with.
Yeah.
Thought it was the coolest thing in the world. And, you know, with all the territories, there's everybody had a different wrestling school somewhere. And I never thought it would ever dwindle down to where there's really now one world-class center that is training the bulk of people that are going to be the future of the industry for here going forward for, you know, as long as it lasts, which is seemingly will be forever. But things have changed so much. When you get these people in there, Dusty, because I watched you in the ring, and you had a very unique relationship with the people. There's been many people who got over in a big-time fashion as you were, but the just the way you would look to the people to bring them in, maybe wave a little bit with the hand, but sometimes not acknowledge them because it wasn't time to acknowledge them. So many times some of these young cats want to go to the people, and it's like, hey, you haven't earned that respect yet. You can't go there yet. How long did it take you to just develop such a natural rapport or relationship, a personal relationship with people that were either watching on TV or the people that you had cramming into the arenas when y'all were selling out all throughout your career? How long of a process was it for you to really relate to those people?
Don't laugh, and this ain't a bullshit answer here. I go back to what I told you earlier, man. Just very simple. The first slap.
Yep.
My instinct was I wanted the people to know it hurt. I wanted them to form an opinion about they're glad I'm hurt or they're not glad I'm hurt or they're, oh, the poor baby's hurt. Right. I wanted an opinion out of them. So I didn't know it at the time of the question you asked, if that's what I was forming.
Right.
But it became, once you become a star, see, people, there are so many people, we forget this, that have not been where you have been. They have not stood there and heard this roar so loud and chanting your name and that glass breaking, and you're standing there and you're in the midst of it in a calm storm, and you have that look on your face to where you know I'm going to go on the top rope and I'm going to hold one finger up and this place is going to go bonkers. I'm going to shake my ass, do the flip, flop, and fly, and raise that elbow without hitting Superstar Billy Graham in the Garden. Just raise it. And as I raised that elbow, it just became like, wow. And it's like a drug, and people don't understand that. Even writers and cheap writers and all this crap, they don't understand our business is like a drug. Once you inhale it, once you take it, and once you become a big-time addicted player, as me and you are, we are addicted to this drug. It will never get out of your system. No matter what it is, we live to entertain, but we live for that moment to where the pop is so loud. The money don't matter. The money don't matter. The peace of mind now is that pop is so loud, and knowing that this weekend, because of what you did there, you're going to be sitting in a deer blind without a gun, just sitting there for the whole time looking out and watching life in front of you transpire, watch it happen. And that's philosophizing right now that I'm doing. Your dreamingism and philosophizing are two different things, but that's what it's all about. And, you know, if people would, they don't need to understand it. They just need to enjoy it. It will always continue to be what it is, but people make the marks. I made a mark, like it or not. You made a mark, like it or not. Hogan made a mark, like it or not. Cena's making a mark, like it or not. That's it. Everybody else are big players. That's not knocking Rock. That's not knocking Superstar Billy Graham. That's not knocking CM Punk of the current. I went through the whole areas here. But you know, they are big players in your movie, buddy. And I'm sorry, but that's just the way it is.
You can follow Dusty on Twitter at WWE Dusty Road.
You're listening to another classic episode of The Steve Austin Show, only on Podcast One.
Check it out, car lovers. Car waxes have really come a long way. Just last year, Meguiar's introduced their hybrid ceramic spray wax. With this bright blue bottle, you can't miss it. Its advanced SiO2 hybrid technology delivers ceramic wax protection and durability far beyond traditional wax. And it's incredibly easy to use. Simply wash your car, spray on Meguiar's hybrid ceramic spray wax, then just rinse off for extreme water beating action. No rubbing, no curing, buffing, and the best part, no mess. I'm told the product has been flying off the shelves. And this year, knowing some prefer a more traditional style of application, Meguiar's has launched their liquid version, Meguiar's Hybrid Ceramic Liquid Wax. Long-lasting ceramic protection in an easy-to-use wax. Seals the paint for long-lasting protection against the elements, and also delivers the same extreme water-beating action. Easy to use, applies just like a traditional liquid wax with no wax residue. Meguiar's also launched a hybrid ceramic spray detailer for in-between boosted maintenance. This removes contaminants like dust, fingerprints, or those pesky bird droppings, boosts gloss, and enhances protection in a flash. And it also contains SiO2 hybrid ceramic protection. Achieve that just washed look by gently removing fresh contaminants between regular washes before they have the chance to bond. Meguiar's has a hybrid ceramic solution for everyone. For incredible water beating, protection, and durability beyond traditional wax, check out Meguiar's. It's ceramic made easy. Meguiar's.
All right, so anyway, I'm sitting here at the Broken Skull Ranch in South Texas, and I'm talking to the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes.
Yeah.
In 2010, you did an interview, and I read, you know, you said, you know, today, you know, Vince is more about, you know, we're putting smiles on people's faces. And I believe that to be true. But you also said, you went on to say, back in the day, it was more about the blood, guts, and glory. And it was a whole different environment back then. Let's go back to, you know, kind of that period there in the 80s in the Carolinas when Crockett still owned National Wrestling Alliance, NWA. That was some of that. When I do cardio to this day, if I want to watch, as I was talking to a guest on a show the other day, when I go to my garage and do cardio, if I'm going to put wrestling in, it's 9 times out of 10, it's going to be stuff from the NWA, from Crockett Promotions.
Yeah.
There, when you guys were running roughshod, I mean, you know, you had Ivan Nikita Koloff, you had Arn Anderson, of course you had Flair, Steamboat, Man with the Hands of Stone, Ronnie Garvin, the Midnight at Rock and Roll Express, all of those guys, Magnum TA, and you guys were running some heavy-duty angles. And God dang, you had some over-baby faces, but you had a ton of heels with a lot of heat. And you must have heat to draw some money. And you guys made sure that you got your heels hot.
If the audience don't want to see you beat up somebody, if they're not mad at him, what the hell? I mean, you know, okay, if Roy's got on Trigger and he's at the Percy show and somebody don't come over and beat up Dale, then I ain't going to be mad at anybody until Roy gets him at the end. So if somebody come over and shove Dale Evans down in the dirt, well, by the end of that 30-minute show or whatever it was, Roy's going to beat somebody up. Roy's going to kick somebody's ass.
Right.
John Wayne's going to kick somebody's ass. Steve Austin's going to kick somebody's ass. And I just wanted to clarify, too, because you just mentioned something about having a guest on there. When I opened up this podcast thing with you, is that I was saying, now you got the main event. Everybody you've had on this show, anybody that's ever done anything in our business, I consider them a lot better than me in main event. So I was just joking about that. Got that out of the way. That way I get everybody off my ass. So now, but I don't believe that. I just said that. Anyway, but now it is, that was you just called it. It was Woody Harrelson and the killer. It was, you know, the taxi. It was, you know, I want you to meet my little friend.
Yeah.
It was that, and that was it. Let's go. That's what we were dealing with, that man. And it became consistent with what was happening in the universe. I mean, I was lucky to be a part of that era, because that was such a fun era. Because
it was fun for me to watch. I wanted to jump through
the
TV screen and beat the shit out of some of these guys. I remember,
yes,
you know, when Flair was working with Nikita Koloff in a cage, and
The match was over. Ivan Koloff came down. He jumps Ric Flair. They're doing a number on him. Plus, your Khrushchev comes to hold the cage door shut so nobody can get in that motherfucker. And then all of a sudden, you come down, help clear the ring, start dropping bionic elbows. You help out Ric Flair, and Flair's starting to say something to you, and I'll be damned if Arn and Ole Anderson jump your ass from behind. Then Flair jumps in. They're triple teaming you. And break your ankle. And I'll tell you, you can watch the crowd. And, of course, this was in that golden age of pro wrestling when it was real, brother. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that,
I know.
The whole crowd, they're all on their feet. They're watching it. And you're selling your ass off. And he's talking about, man, I might have to cut up your jean leg to expose that leg to see the damage. And you were selling it. And more people were madder than a motherfucker. I was.
Hey, yeah, but Steve, but there you go. Here's the thing about that. We go back to the word sell again. We jump back in there, and the layman fan out there, you know, can it kind of understands a little bit, but we really understand it. And that was what I was going with you when you were in the hole and you refused to. I mean, the sell of that moment made Steve Austin. I mean, it was just, this guy is not going to stop or quit for anything. So going back to that, to where they broke the leg. You remember what we used to call, we had a saying back in the day, white heat. Okay, yes. White heat was when they broke my leg and the arena would get stone cold quiet.
Yep.
That roar would stop and you would look out there and it would last about 20 seconds.
Yep.
And then at the, as they were absorbing what they just seen.
Yep.
And that white heat started to build, and that's what we call, hey, Rube. That's what we said, they're getting ready to be a riot here.
Right.
Because once they realize that that the dude just went down, buddy, and these guys are still standing there, it was like suspended in time. It was like an era that it just like everything was in slow motion. Until they decided, now the roar becomes, and as the roar came, here they came. And as they came, and we would finally get back a little bit worn, and, you know, guys would get back and the heels would get back and say, wow, man, I mean, you know what, that was amazing. But you can't do that nowadays because of, social media. I mean, WWE is way more about the entertainment aspect of our whole industry, whether it's giving money to the, you know, to all of the foundations we do and all the work we do at WWE and all the work you did and all the groundwork we did. But when we talk about just wrestling and we talk about them eras that set the tone for what we're doing, why would Vince want to buy something that wasn't successful? Why would he want to own the whole world if it wasn't successful and he had his vision of where he wanted to go? So there we are. I mean, it's just that simple. And we just, you know, you're so much younger than me. It's cool. But, you know, just old fart, you know, we just, you know what I mean? We're just dwelling in the past, but the past was good. You gotta go. If you ain't got no past, you ain't got no future, kid.
Yeah, but I like talking about this, some of the heyday stuff that I grew up watching, because along in that same, area of time, you know, I think Magnum was backstage in a dressing room cutting a promo on Tully Blanchard. I guess they were fixing to have a match for that U.S. title. And I'll be damned if Ole and Arn didn't jump in there and beat the hell out of him and leave him in a bad way. And I know you and Magnum T.A. seem to have a good personal relationship behind the scenes, and was he somewhat of a protege of yours? How did you come to meet young Terry?
No, I think he was the next in line, man. I had chosen him because I had that much power at the time.
Right.
And so
at this time, you're booking behind the scenes.
I had power.
Right.
There were two people with power, and it was Vince Sr. and myself.
Right.
And Eddie Graham had put me into power, and I had a tremendous amount of power, and then Vince Jr. came in, of course. And then, unbelievable power that I didn't even realize at the time that I had. But with Magnum, he was the chosen one. He was the golden boy before the accident.
Good looking.
Took it all away from him.
Jesus Christ, barrel chest, good looking, the hair, the mustache.
Yeah.
The whole
movie star.
Very believable.
Yeah.
And he just always kind of went straight forward and never backed
down
from anything. And
yes,
he was the next hot thing. So what happened with that damn car wreck that he had in that Porsche?
Magnum loved speed, man. He would go out to NASCAR. He'd go out to Charlotte Motor Speedway and get in a car that he'd never been in before. And we had some friends out there with Hendrix and them guys. He would go out there and, you know, go 180 miles an hour, and they would try to wave him in or just out there just by himself and never been in the car before. And just he loved speed. And I always say this. I'll tell you how successful Crockett became when I drove up to the office the first time. There were some old cars and some old ragged old Buicks, and nothing was wrong with Buicks and stuff, but all these old things around there. And I said, after about a year, pretty close to a year, I drove up that same parking lot. There was white Harleys, there was Mercedes, there was brand new trucks with chrome wheels. And I said, this is success. It becomes successful. We were rock stars back then. We traveled in jets before it was fashionable. We were rock stars. And we had no fear of Gotham. And, he had no fear of us. And I think that's when, even as the times changed with TBS, when you became the Hollywood blonde, I mean, there was so much young talent that finally when they got their shit together as you did, you went out and became this unbelievable person. So back then, man, it was just, it was blood and guts, and the song tells it all. It was rock and roll.
You're listening to another classic episode of The Steve Austin Show, only on Podcast One.
Hey, have you checked out the Jordan Harbinger Show yet? The Jordan Harbinger Show is an Apple Top 50 podcast and was among Apple's best of 2018 as well. Jordan covers all types of topics, not to mention amazing stories from the people who lived them. From getting kidnapped by Al-Qaeda and escaping to go undercover as a CIA agent in Moscow to illusionists who can seemingly program our minds. The mission of the Jordan Harbinger Show is to help you become a better informed, more critical thinker so you can get a much deeper understanding of how the world works and make sense of what's really happening. Check out some of these episodes. Episode number 282, How an Art Forger Got Away with Making Millions Despite Being Chased by the Mafia and the Feds. This isn't pop psychology and superficial advice, nor is it BS inspiration porn. This is meaningful, fun, life-changing insights with a practical edge so listeners can apply something right out of the box. He even has worksheets for every episode. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
But by the talk about blood and guts, you talked about me being in that sharpshooter hole and that blood not giving up, passing out. Over the years, you have shed a lot of blood.
Yes.
Was that something that I enjoyed that? You know, when it was the right time, I just enjoyed it. What was, and obviously you probably had to dig it too. Man, when the Dream was in a bad way, he was usually bleeding pretty severely.
Yeah. I thought about that a lot. You know, when I sit in some of these hunting blinds and just have my gun down and don't care about what's walking and whatever, it has to come and stand underneath my blind for me to do anything with it because I'm not there for that purpose. And I thought about that. And I said, man, why don't you do this, man? Why not? Why the cigarette and your noggin's all messed up and all these things. And it was that moment again that we just talked about way earlier. The thrill of that moment, the rush that you got, the addiction to this business, to make it real. You wanted them to believe it was real. And it was real for that moment.
Yeah.
And you wanted that to happen. And it was just, I mean, my God, when you just stood there and you came up and it was all over your face. And you started that slow comeback, and it was just like, bam, elbow. It would sound, instead of just a bam, it would sound like a bomb going off.
Yeah.
Like, boom, boom, boom. And just about the time to where you had it right at its high point, at its very high point, then one of the old horsemen or whoever would roll in and cut your legs off from under you, and you'd start all over again. Nothing more beautiful than that, buddy.
Let's talk about traveling down the road. I know when you guys got really hot and you were rock stars, you were flying everywhere, but there had been a lot of a lot of road trips with you and Dickie Murdoch traveling down the road and either in a shitbox or whatever you guys were driving and drinking some beer on that road. And you and Dickie Murdoch had a hell of a tag team called the Texas Outlaws.
Yeah.
And how long were you guys together, and what did you want to split up because you saw the singles path as your destiny? Because you weren't the American Dream yet. That wouldn't happen until you went down to Florida, correct?
Yes, correct, 74.
So how did you
And it just came out of my mouth. Well, it was, I even when I was in power, I had lieutenants. And Barry Windham, even at 19 and 20 years old, he was a lieutenant.
Right.
What I mean by that is he watched my back, and I'm going to just mention him a second. Barry was the most natural talented, besides Dustin, most natural talented that's walking the ring, and probably one of the greatest in-ring performers in our history. But there was no one, my friend, as great a performer as Dick Murdoch. Jose Lothario, I always thought, was close. But Murdoch, Dick Murdoch, at 50%, which he would go some nights, or at 70%, which he would go some nights, but at 95 and 100, there was no one that could touch him, period. But we had one thing in common. We loved the road, we loved the travel, we loved country music, and we loved beer. We would leave, as you, I'm sure you have done on numerous occasions, but we would leave. We're not talking about taking drugs or anything like that. We're talking about beer.
Yep.
And he was a cheap son of a bitch, God rest his soul. He would buy beer in New Orleans to make a trip to Alexander with no label on it. It would be in a white can. I don't know where in the shit this came from.
Yep.
And it tasted like panther piss.
Yep.
I don't know where it came from. When it was my turn to buy the beer, then I would get, you know, I would try to get something that at least had a name on it, whether
name
it was Jack's,
rest, yeah.
Jack's or Pearl or something like that.
Yeah.
It was cheap. And we would put 24 and double 24 sometime. The white cooler, the styrofoam cooler, where you put your hand in and finally break and the water would boil over the back seat. We did that many times. We'd pack it with ice. The first thing we did when we got to a town was not go to the arena. Would go to the store, get the beer, and ice it down and put it in the back seat. That was the most important thing that was going to happen that night, period. And then it didn't have Sirius satellite radio, didn't have what you're doing right now, broadcast and all this stuff. None of that was social media was there. So we'd go AM, 820, Bill Mack Show, Fort Worth, Dallas, every night, even in Michigan, we could pick it up and we'd turn it on, and Murdoch would throw his head back, the worst singer in the history of the world, and would sing these songs we'd just go down the road night after night after night after night after night till one morning I woke up in some old hotel and I looked across the bed next to me and them old white BBDs all yellow stained up and shit sitting over there, big ass sticking out from under the cover, smell like, you know, donkey piss in the place. And I finally had got word, I said, I want to try this on my own. We were in Detroit.
Yeah.
And I walk in and I tell 84 I had the Sheik and Jack Kane, who was a booker. I said, I'd like to give him a notice. I want to move on. And I look behind me, and it's Murdoch. He's sitting there and said, well, me too. I said, no, no. I said, excuse me just a minute. Sheik, I said, let me walk out here. I said, Dick, I just want to go on my own here. We've been together so long, night and day, went through families, all this stuff. I just want to go and try something on my own. And so that we always remained close, but that was really, there was never again that day-to-day travel stories down the road, hitting beer signs, shooting guns, putting Cosmo Rosario in the back of a truck, telling Kate Fade, lay down, and we took him at 20 degrees to Minard, North Dakota, wouldn't let him out of the bed of the truck, and we were in the truck with the heater on, and the guy nearly froze to death. I mean, we would rib unbelievably back during that period of time. So
how many days a month were you guys on the road? Because it had to be very extensive, more so than today.
I think we always around Thanksgiving night we always worked. That was huge. Starcade, let's go back to Crockett, let's go back to the Omni in Atlanta. New Year's Eve we worked, and Christmas Day we worked. They were the three big days.
But the days that you were home, probably only home maybe 2 days every here and there, but then always back out on the road.
No, but it was the only time would be Christmas time, probably around the 19th. We're back on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
So 300 and some days or whatever they are.
That's
too,
what
you
I'm
know. I mean, year after year after year, where the years pile up, you say, man, you know, I got to slow down. This has been 8 years. This has been 9 years. Whoa, wait a minute. Holy. Let's stop. You know what I mean? Because nobody knows your product better than you. You are your product.
Right.
You're standing there, your product. Why turn it over to somebody else when you work so hard to get to this level?
So what happened?
Turn this over.
What happened to the relationship with Dick Murdoch? I know he's one of your closest friends, but
yes.
As you decided to go on your own and go down the singles path, did it hurt his feelings? Was he cool with it? Did he understand?
No, I don't think he did at first. I think,
right.
You know, we always, we had some property in Colorado. We all kind of together and, you know, we bought some property out there back when it was, you know, going out to Southern Colorado there, in Kachara up in the mountains there. We had some property and we would hunt and would be together. And I always low keyed around him. I never tried to be, I just wanted to be who he met and who I was because I always looked up to him. So no matter how big a star I was, he resented probably the American Dream type deal and what I was doing back then. He was not a racist as people think he was, but he had his beliefs in the way he believed, period. And that's what it was. And, I was dealing with a different clientele and a different people and he was still dealing with, redneck Dick Murdoch. I mean, you know, it's just,
right.
Just that simple. I'll defend him to the end because that's, you know,
right.
That's what he was. I loved him as close to my brother. So we always remain close, but I think it wasn't jealousy, Steve. It's not, there's a difference. You know that. It was just like, okay, I kind of left him here and I went on because how many people, when you do stuff like that, that you know, how many people that you know, begrudge your shit and blame you? Think about that 100 times now when I'm booking and shit. Blame you for their downfall or why they couldn't keep up. And so they put it all on you and say, oh, they either pushed me out or done this. That's harsh shit. Because you had being pushed is one thing. Being in the position I'm in or was in was another thing. When you were as powerful as I was, you're going to have distractors. So Murdoch never was a distractor. He was all he was there for me, but he went his own way, and I went my own way.
So then right then, when you went your own way, was that when you went down to Championship Wrestling in Florida to work for Eddie Graham?
Yeah. Yes. I went back there and I said, that's where I'm going. And we had been there in 69.
But and still, you were not the American Dream yet.
No.
The American Dream was fiction to be born.
You're listening to another classic episode of The Steve Austin Show, only on Podcast One.
Did you know that right now GEICO is offering an extra 15% credit on car, motorcycle, and RV policies? That's 15% on top of the money GEICO can already save you. So what are you waiting for? Your dog to make you breakfast in bed? With Belgian waffles and a fresh fruit compote, as nice as that sounds, that's probably never going to happen. But at least there's never been a better time to switch to GEICO. Save an extra 15% when you switch by October 7th. Visit GEICO.com to learn more.
I want to ask you about Eddie Graham, because I never got a chance to work for Eddie Graham, but I have heard so much about this guy as far as how smart he was about the business and just he was just a genius or a savant at it, and he was a great finish guy. What was it about Eddie Graham that was so genius?
Timing. And timing might not mean a lot to a lot of people, but timing, knowing when, how, what to do at what moment. His timing was immaculate. His thought on timing as far as the fan, you could say timing. They're not ready yet. I said, man, I want to go in there and kick this guy's ass. He beat me up for last week. Eddie said, no, there's a formal thing going on here. They're going to introduce you. You're going to get in. They're going to ring a bell, and you're going to start a match. You're not going to go over and jump in because he beat you up. You're going to build this thing until the time is right.
Right.
So, and going on with Gordon Soley and saying
right.
The American Dream as an overall thing. I wanted all the everyone to believe in this American Dream, not that I was personally the American Dream. And when I said it, it caught on like wildfire. It's just like things you would say. And then when I said it, it caught on because I was against who? Gary Hart and the Korean Assassin.
Right.
America against the Korean Assassin. It was in Florida, and it just went boom. And Eddie guided me through that whole thing to where everything with him, if you were an hour at the 55-minute mark, this is what you did. This
right.
is what went down at 55 minutes. And if I did not do it at 55 minutes, he would ream my ass when I got back. He would set me down and say, you will never be successful if you do not follow these rules. Okay? And I said, there are times, though, Eddie, that the rules will change because the people will change.
Right.
He said, but they didn't change tonight. And I knew they wouldn't. Your timing was bad. Timing. And he could think of finishes. Vince Sr. would call him on finishes.
Right.
Really? They would call him. Don Orange would call him. Bob Geigel would call him. Sam Mushnick would call him. And say, so, you know, I've got Steve Austin and Dick Murdoch in St. Louis this Friday night. And, you know, it's a 1 hour time limit for the Missouri State Champion. And what do you think, man, you know? And, man, he would pluck them eyebrows. He would sit down in about 30 minutes. And then you would have from the – if it's a 30-minute match, from minute 1 to minute 30 would be filled with timing and what was going to happen if he took you to – he was a great writer. Unbelievable.
Right, right, right. So he mentored you, and obviously
yes.
your whole career you've kind of had an aptitude to soak all this knowledge in. As he mentored you, was there just some reason he took you under his wing? He liked what he saw in you, the future in you? Did he mentor everybody?
Yeah, he mentored a lot of guys, Steve, but as you know yourself, with Vince Jr., people love money. People in power that are your bosses, they love money, man.
Right.
They love money, okay? They was making money. He knew I was the money maker.
Right.
But here's a story that people don't know because they don't know who I'm talking about. They are the younger kids. Dr. Jerry Graham and Eddie Graham were the biggest things in New York City as a tag team way back in the 60s.
Right.
It was phenomenal how over they were. And Dr. Jerry Graham was a big, blonde, heavyset guy like me that shook his ass. I watched him on tape. I got a lot of stuff from him for his movements and everything. When you go back and say, where did this come from?
Really?
It's a cross between him and Thunderbolt Patterson.
Yeah.
Everything came from there. So, Dr. Jerry and Eddie were very close. And, they became alcoholics together. And I mean, true alcoholics. God rest his soul. You know, Eddie. But the bottom line was that he seen when he got me, he seen this guy that didn't look like a bodybuilder, that had the beer gut, that had this blonde hair and an Afro-type wig in the 70s almost. Not yeah. wig, but real hair.
Yeah.
You know, flowing everywhere and could talk like a black guy and talk like an evangelist and talk them in the building
yeah.
as Dr. Jerry Graham did.
Right.
And he related to me through that. And, of course, God rest his soul, too. My Graham, his son, was yeah. a smaller guy, a tremendous hand in the ring, a great worker, and a very dear friend. But the bottom line was, I was Eddie's wrestling son.
Yeah.
Mike was his son, but I became Eddie's unspoken word was I was Eddie Graham's wrestling son. I was his Dr. Jerry Graham in a new era in a younger form.
So then Mike Graham was very instrumental in helping me when I was down in WCW.
Yes.
And, you know, we would
yeah.
talk about the Florida days, and there was
sure.
a territory I never
yeah.
got to work but heard so much about. So how was the American Dream born?
Gary Hart. And Pakistan, the Korean Assassin,
yep.
was really hot, and Eddie knew they were hot. And I went on TV in 74 with Gordon Solie, who was the dean at the time. And that was the only TVs. We had three different hours of TVs on the weekends. TBS was getting ready to make me a huge star. And I said, you know, all of us have to have that American dream. We have to reach out there, and we have to find it. And on the interview, it had nothing to do with the match. I just said it.
Yeah.
And I said, the American dream is important, man. And sometimes I feel like that American dream, like I'm carrying it for all of you. The rest is like the crowd doing one word things that we have now. Who would have thought that you could just change the crowd and say, yes, 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 yes.
Yeah.
What?
Right.
What? I mean, think about that. So back then it was just something that they picked it up. The audience. The universe picked it up, and they made it huge. Then newspapers picked it up. Then people started talking about it. And then me against the Korean assassin. And so how did he become that babyface? How did he become that deal? It was simple. We talked about the great promo. The greatest promo, I said two lines. I love you. That was my favorite, greatest promo. If you ever get a YouTube where you can find it, you can.
Yeah, it was for Orlando.
Yeah. It was for Orlando. I had 2 minutes. For a minute, 50-something seconds, I looked at Garden. I looked into the camera and didn't say nothing. And Orlando had turned me babyface the week before, and it was me and the assassin there. Everybody knew where I was, but until they already told him. And I looked at them. I looked at the camera, and I said, with about 3 or 4 seconds left, I said, Orlando, I love you. You could not get within 5 miles of that building at 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
Orlando, I love you. You know why? Because they believed I was sitting out there with them. And they took me to the dance, and by God, I'm going to leave with them.
Before we wrap up, and you know, I want to have you back on the show to talk about so much more. We covered a lot of ground just in general conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But sure. Where did you start, Dusty? That was in New York City?
No, Boston. Boston Arena Annex 45 years ago, November 14th.
But you
first match against Lenny Montana.
Lenny Montana and Boston match.
Yeah, he must be 180 now.
But you and Dickie Murdoch were the Texas Outlaws.
Right.
AWA. Kansas City.
No, Kansas City first. So I left there and I went to Dallas, Danny Pletches, Bulldog Danny Pletches, namely Dusty Rhodes. And Fritz put me on top right away with him. I had something, whatever it was. The Squaller was there, and Gary Hart and the Army and all that.
Right.
Great era. Wouldn't have traded that, but I went on then, because back then you'd go to 28 different territories.
Yep.
So I went to Kansas City, said, you need some seasoning, Fritz said. And I went there to Kansas City, and all the offices back in them days were in the old hotels downtown. The rundown hotel, still to this day, you get your tickets for the Garden in the rundown hotel where Arnie Skolan was, God rest his soul. So the bottom line was, you go into a hotel, I'm sitting in one room, I hear this voice in the other room, and there's a big blonde guy that I remember from the time I went to the matches with Frank Goodich, who became Bruiser Brody. Me and Frank would go get save our money, bail hay during the week from school during the off-season football at West Texas. And we seen this guy always at ringside with this blonde, bleached blonde hair, and it was Dick Murdoch. We didn't know who he was. And I looked in the other room, and there he was. Bob Dagger walks in and said, listen, I'm going to make you two guys a tag team. This is Dick Murdoch. This is Dusty Rhodes. We shook hands, and the rest is history. Love affair with Barn.
What would you say your favorite promotion or favorite time was through it all, Dusty?
70s. Yeah, more than the 80s. Cool.
Why so? Because of just the purity
more,
of it? Because it was so much fun and out on the road, living hard and working hard?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the 80s became work for me.
Right.
It became stressful.
It's a grind.
Being on top
and being on the road and not having I kind of could have done a lot better with my family life, man. I was on the road too much.
Wow.
And when I wasn't on
my mind was on the road.
Yeah. So, but the 70s was the most fun for you. And sometimes when I look back, I mean, some of my most fun days were when I was, you know, starting off in Dallas in that year and a half I spent in Tennessee, basically starving to death. But, you know, running up that road, doing what I wanted to do with a bunch of badass veterans and asking questions.
Yeah.
And, you know, learning the trade. And so you got to come back. We got to talk some more. I want to talk to you about your days in the WWE stuff, you know, and back in the NWA. Bounce around some more specific stuff about Florida. But I appreciate you taking time to come on the show. You've always been one of my favorites. And, you know, next time maybe we'll talk a little bit about the booking process, your psychology, maybe what you picked up from Eddie Graham, some of your own stuff mixed in there with the creative flair that you brought to the booking situation when you had the book and that whole dynamic of the power play. So, anyway, I've been telling you American Dream, Dusty Rhodes. You can follow Dusty on Twitter. At WWE Dusty Rhodes. How you digging that Twitter stuff, Dusty?
Not too good, man. I'm not really a social media guy, but I use it. Stephanie will, she'll call me and get on my ass for not using it. So I at least got to say, hey, I talked to Steve today. So that'll get me like, you know, thousands and thousands of hits. I wouldn't know how you get a hit on there. But I just want to tell you I appreciate it. I'd love to come back anytime. And I just love talking to you, and I don't want to blow your smoke up the ass, but you were truly one of my favorite performers of all time, because there's nothing better, except me in the 70s. There was nothing better than the stuff you did with Vince McMahon that I believe revolutionized and saved the WWE to what it is now today. So that has nothing to do with money, man. That has to do with the passion and love for what you were doing. And we're friends and we're hunters. And, yeah, if you're out there and you're a hunter and you can let one walk and it might grow next year and you don't need meat for that table or your family, or you don't need to make venison chili for the shut-in homes that we take chili to every year, keep hunting alive, and it's peace of mind. The woods are peace of mind. And without your past, man, you don't have a future. So hang on to it, because that's all you leave with is your memories. And, Steve, I appreciate it. And I know that I could talk another 4, 5, or 6 hours.
We're going to down the road.
Okay.
I know my
right.
Brothers have enjoyed the stories. I love hearing the stories. I can sit here and be a fan. And we opened up a can of audio whoop ass. And with that being said, the American dream will ride off into the sunset. I'm going to come right back, wrap up this conversation, and talk about a few things going into my next show. Dusty, thank you very much. I'll catch you down the road.
Thank you, kid.
Thank you for joining us for another classic episode of The Steve Austin Show. Please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts and tell your friends. For more Steve Austin Show, go to podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.